What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff. In a legal face-off, hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Rich Lenkov, Jason Whiteside sitting right here with me. And I'm Craig Collins, not Sam Penionovich. I'm not going to be mistaken for him on the street anywhere. I am... here with you guys.
A little
today.
Height difference. Just
right. A little height difference, a little sound difference. I'm here because...
And you actually, by the way, read the stuff in preparation for today. So
yeah,
That's the big difference right there.
Well, Sam is ill, as so we've heard, and he's sparing us of getting sick too. So thank you, Sam. Get better. Our first guest, it's very exciting to talk about this off the top because I can't tell you how many times I've heard of the Logan Act in the last few weeks. And I've never heard of it before that. And I'm sure that you guys are a little bit more experts on it. And our guest, Professor Stephen Vladek from the University of Texas School of Law, is certainly an expert on it. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, let me ask you, is that the only time in your life that you've heard the word exciting and Logan Act in the same sentence?
At least not coming from my mouth.
Well, not to degrade it, but the Logan Act is somewhat older. It's from 1799, and... It, as Craig mentioned, is in the news over the last week or so because of accusations that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn might have violated it when he was communicating with the Russian ambassador. So tell us first, as the expert on the Logan Act, what it is and why it is now in the news.
Sure. I mean, the Logan Act is, as you say, a very, 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 very old federal criminal statute. It was enacted in the 1790s, and we have to sort of go back to the politics of that moment. You know, the Hamilton, the musical version, you had the Federalists and you had the Jeffersonians or the Democratic Republicans. Federalists were in charge of both Congress and the White House. John Adams was the president. And George Logan was this Pennsylvania doctor who really thought that we were screwing up our foreign policy by basically throwing in with the British against the French. And so he basically tried to conduct a one-man foreign policy mission in his private capacity with the French government. Congress did not take to that very well, and so the same Congress that brought us such treasures as the Alien and Sedition Acts and a couple of other statutes that have long since been relegated to the dustbin of history made it a crime for anyone without authority of the United States, that's the phrase in the statute, to attempt to influence foreign policy through conduct of intercourse with foreign nations, where the idea was to defeat the measures of the United States or to change a foreign government's policy toward the United States. And that's been on the statute books now for the better part of 218 years.
All right. And if the policy or the doctrine behind the Logan Act is to keep Americans from corresponding or engaging with other foreign nations, how do they break that down or justify it? And today, when communication with other foreign nations is so easy now compared with when the Logan Act was enacted in the 1790s.
Yeah, I mean, so the Logan Act wasn't meant to prohibit all communication. I mean, I think the Logan Act was meant to prohibit basically lobbying by private citizens on foreign policy questions that might affect our foreign relations. The idea being that it's one thing if I send a letter of adoration to Angela Merkel. It's another thing if I, you know, try to basically explain to her why our foreign policy should be changed and try to get her to change her foreign policy toward the United States. That's the theory behind the Logan Act. I mean, I think you guys are already pointing at some of the ways in which it's deeply anachronistic and, frankly, has never been used. There have been, you know, one or two indictments under the Logan Act, but none since basically the 1800s, the first decade of the 19th century. And yet every time someone who we don't like gets in trouble for communicating with the foreign government, lately this is what gets dusted off, you know, off the shelves.
So fast forward to the most recent example, General Flynn. So last week when Trump fired him from his National Security Council or as National Security Advisor, he specifically said that it wasn't because Flynn broke a law. Now, Trump didn't reference the Logan Act, but he said that Flynn didn't break any laws, but rather he was fired by Trump because of this breach in trust over the communication that Flynn had with Pence. In your opinion, is what Flynn did, and we only know what he did based on the fact that the Russia communications were leaked. Assuming that's true, did Flynn break the Logan Act?
So, I mean, let me say first, I don't think it matters. But since you asked the direct question, I don't think so. And I think the key on that point is the phrase without authority of the United States. If, you know, if folks want to look this up, it's Title 18, U.S. Code, Section 953. I think that when you have a presidential transition team, it's actually a bit of a stretch to argue that their communications with foreign governments are wholly without the authority of the United States, because, frankly, it's just a matter of weeks at that point before they're going to be the people exercising that authority more directly. So I think it's a stretch even on the text of the statute, because it's not going to matter for two other reasons. And the statute, we've talked about how it's anachronistic. Its anachronisms are more than just a historical curiosity. I think they also raise constitutional problems, because in one respect, the Logan Act is what the modern Supreme Court would call a content-based restriction on speech. That is to say, it's regulating someone's speech based on what the content is, as opposed to where he's saying it or how he's saying it. We tend to be very skeptical of those kinds of regulations today because they smack of censorship. And the Logan Act is also remarkably vague insofar as it not being immediately obvious exactly where the line is between what it prohibits and what it allows. So wholly apart from it never being used, I think even if you could argue that Michael Flynn did violate it, and again, I think that's a long shot, there'd be some pretty serious constitutional problems with applying that statute in today's basically legal landscape.
Well, I watched some of Trump's blazing news conference on Thursday, the hour and 15-minute segment there. But he did state unequivocally that Flynn didn't do anything wrong. Flynn was, you know, communicating with foreign governments like he was supposed to. And the only thing that he, you know, fired Flynn for was because of the way he communicated with Vice President Pence. But is now that the Logan Act has been brought to light, Professor Vladek, is it time to get rid of it?
Probably. But to me, the more interesting question
Logan's
is...
Logan's family says no. It's the one claim to fame.
It'll be in Hamilton Part 2, right? They'll have the Logan
Act. Seriously. Exactly. But guys, I mean, I think the question is whether we think there's a real-world problem in 21st century politics that something like the Logan Act could be used to solve. That is to say, put aside Mike Flynn, is there a situation today where we actually do worry about those who are not in the executive branch, let's say members of Congress, for example, who might use their prestige and the power of their office to thwart the executive branch's foreign policy, to interfere with foreign relations, which the Supreme Court has said time and time again is really the exclusive province and responsibility of the president. That, to me, is an interesting question, and one that Congress might want to think seriously about legislating around. The problem is that if that's the question, the Logan Act is a broadsword, not a scalpel.
But the reality, but to your point, I mean, isn't the reality that in today's world, I mean, no one really thinks that when Trump, for example, calls on Russia to hack into Hillary's emails when he was a candidate, or when Tom Cotton writes a letter to the leaders of Iran saying that we're going to overturn the Iran deal, the reality is no one in Iran really thinks that that letter is being written on the authority of the U.S. government. They realize it's a political stunt, right? I mean, everyone, it's a small world, and people don't think today, maybe as they did in the 1700s, that a letter coming out of the U.S., even though it's signed by 46 senators, as the Iran deal letter was, that it really is anything more than a political stunt. Isn't that really the bottom line?
I suspect that's right, but at the very least, it seems like Congress ought to have that conversation, and Congress ought to figure out whether there is any remaining scope of conduct, given today's world, given that, as you say, I think it would be transparently obvious that these are political stunts. You know, I think this is why we have a legislature, to actually think about where the line should be between what is just political theater and what is actually illegal. The Logan Act, I think, is pretty useless right now for anything other than interesting copy. And the question I think that folks really need to grapple with is there anything worth preserving from this otherwise vestigial, anachronistic relic of a different historical era in our constitutional understanding?
And, Professor, just so we're clear, this has nothing to do with the upcoming movie Logan, right? Jason was pretty excited when he saw that we're talking about Logan today.
Yeah, how's Hugh Jackman being played in this movie?
Yeah, this has nothing to do with Wolverine, does it?
I do wonder if at least part of the social media interest in the Logan Act is the obvious and fascinating commercial tie-ins that one could
wait till I can't wait to see his period costume with Wolverine. That's going to be awesome.
I mean, if Dr. George Logan was, in fact, Wolverine at a different point in his
now
life.
That would be cool.
Exactly.
Bring history to life.
Guys, you got
to
save these pitches. We don't want to talk about them here. We don't want to lose our credit on this. Thank you so much, Professor Vladek, for joining us. I know you got to run, but thank you for spending some time on Legal Face Off.
Thanks, guys. It's a pleasure.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
Back on Legal Face Off, Craig Collins here, Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside. Am I supposed to say my name first every single time? Am I supposed to introduce you guys?
You're the biggest celebrity.
You do it regardless, so might as well just keep going with it.
All right, wonderful. Craig Collins is a part of the show, just so anyone knows. Our next guest is the president of the Liberty Justice Center, Pat Hughes. It's wonderful to talk to you today, Pat.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Pat, tell us about this important case that you're involved with, the Janus versus Ask Me case.
Yeah, Mark Janus and a couple of other plaintiffs that we represent are state employees who are not members of a union, but the unions force them to pay what are called fair share dues, ostensibly designed to help the unions pay for collective bargaining. You guys may recall this was an issue in the Friedrichs case that the Supreme Court was going to rule on, and then Justice Scalia died, and it never got ruled on. This is the next case in the pipeline to determine whether these fair share dues are constitutional. Our position is, and we think the Supreme Court with Gorsuch would go this way, is that they're not constitutional. They're a violation of the First Amendment rights of our plaintiffs to freedom of speech and to freedom of association.
All right, and Pat, if these non-union members are paying these dues, do they still get the benefits of the union? I mean, as far as, you know, the benefits package with the health insurance, the negotiating, the bargaining, are those benefits all available to them if they're paying the dues?
Yeah, so that's actually the union's argument, that they're sort of free riding because there's collective bargaining and the union is bargaining on behalf of everyone, and they benefit directly from the union's representation in that regard. But the reality of it is our plaintiffs, and there's all sorts of people like them, thousands in the state of Illinois and many more across the country, who don't have any interest in having the union negotiate on their behalf. They'd rather just negotiate on their own behalf. And because they're free American citizens, they shouldn't be forced to join a group and pay dues for a group that they don't want to be a part of. And we think that this case is currently pending in the Seventh Circuit. We're going to lose in the Seventh Circuit because there's a Supreme Court precedent called Abood from 1977 that the Seventh Circuit will have to follow. But our United States Supreme Court, with Gorsuch on it, we feel is likely to rule in our favor and say these dues are unconstitutional.
What in Gorsuch's past do you think will make him rule in your favor in this case?
So it's very tricky business predicting what a Supreme Court justice is going to do based on his current record. My understanding of Gorsuch's history is to tend towards the more economically conservative and conservative generally. And if he fits into the mold of any of the other four, forget Scalia for a second, any of the other four who are currently on the bench, if he's in that range, there's a likelihood that he'd be the fifth vote. Because in the case that was like this, the Friedrichs case, that was decided 4-4 with the four conservative justices voting that these dues are unconstitutional. So if he's anything like Roberts or Alito or Thomas or Kennedy, forgetting Scalia, then there's a likelihood that he would vote in the favor of our plaintiffs, which is how he should vote, because these dues are unconstitutional.
All right. So, Pat, what would the landscape look like if the Supreme Court ruled in your favor? What would be the result of this?
Well, the result would be ostensibly that if you wanted to work for the state, any state or any governmental body, you could work for the state and not be forced to, A, join a union, which is already a violation of the Constitution. They can't force you. They can't force state employees, for example, to join a union. But it would also prevent unions from taking dues out of your paycheck and using them for any purpose, whether it's collective bargaining or otherwise. So the consequence of this would be obviously more economic freedom for state employees. But then there would be a political consequence, which is a little outside of the law, because the unions obviously rely on these dues to pay their bills. And as Justice Roberts said in the Friedrichs oral arguments, everything a public sector union does is political, right? Because it's always lobbying a governmental entity, even during its collective bargaining. So these dues are being used for political purposes. It would clearly weaken public sector union power because they would have less money and less sort of power through that money to do political activity. And I think, frankly, you know, as an American citizen, forgetting my role as a lawyer in this case, I think that's a good thing for America, for people to have more freedom and for these public sector unions to have less coercive power over non-members.
Pat, any sense of when the Supremes will hear this case?
So we are in front of the Seventh Circuit now, and we're briefing that. They'll make a decision. We'll have oral argument, and they'll make a decision. And the hope would be we're going to lose, and we then would file our cert petition. And the hope would be that they would take it up right away. So, you know, sometime towards the end of this year into next year, with the decision hopefully coming sometime next year. Although it's always hard to predict how quickly or how slowly the Supreme Court will go. This was an issue of major importance to the court. It was going to be a 5-4 decision in the favor of our side of things until Justice Scalia died. And so we think that the court is going to have significant interest if our case is the next one. And it appears that in the pipeline, this will be the next case that would be the test case to overturn this Abood decision from 1977.
Pat, last question. We'll let you go on this. How are things shaping up down in Mesa, Arizona there for spring training?
I think they're shaping up really good. You know, Pat, the other Pat
Hughes.
Oh,
that's, wait a second.
Wait, what are you talking
this
about?
This is not the same Pat Hughes?
Hey, Pat Hughes on WGN Radio. You're someone else? What's going on?
I wish I was that Pat Hughes. You know, he used to be the Brewers guy. So when I was at Marquette University where I did my undergrad, they used to say that to me all the time. And when I graduated there, I said, okay, I'm never going to have to hear another Pat Hughes play-by-play joke again.
And where do you move? With Chicago?
He came to Chicago the same summer I came back to Chicago. So it's been going on forever.
You're a man of many talents.
I get it all the time, guys. And I'm a huge Cub fan, so I don't mind.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Pat. Have fun out there in Mesa, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Really enjoyed it.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
And we're back on Legal Face-Off. We're going to welcome in Sorge Sato. He is a member of Rita and Desjardins and General Counsel for Keeping Chicago Livable. And we're talking about this Airbnb debate that's going on right now and maybe some regulations that are coming. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We've debated on this show this issue. We've had lots of people on both sides of the issue. We want to talk to you today about Wednesday of this week before the City Council of Chicago, specifically the License Committee. They're going to consider a change to the ordinance or a new ordinance or some variation of what was already proposed that's sponsored by Mayor Emanuel. Tell us what that change is, first of all.
Yeah, the License Committee met on the 15th, and this is going to be considered before the full City Council. It's something of a fix-it amendment or a minor repair to the law in response to our lawsuit and the other lawsuit brought by the Liberty Justice Institute. The provisions that they're tightening up or changing are, one, they had in the other ordinance, the original ordinance, it had a requirement that the city officials could, on demand, ask an Airbnb host to provide 3 years worth of guest registration records. Now they have to get a warrant or a subpoena and actually pre-clock compliance review. The second is a change in the attestation requirement, which is a condition precedent to even putting up a listing on Airbnb. Before, it said that every host had to attest under oath that they had read and understood this 57-page law. Now they have to read in a summary that's produced by a third party and acknowledge that operating a shared housing unit is subject to those requirements. And the third has to do with the change to the definition of guest suites, which is something they introduced at the last minute on the 15th.
All right, so let's talk about the first one you mentioned, the requirement that you have to turn over 3 years worth of guests to City Hall on demand. Your general counsel to a nonprofit, Keep Chicago Livable, which is formed by current and former Airbnb hosts. You filed, or your organization filed, a 73-page lawsuit last year that accused the city of basically violating owners' constitutional rights to provide Airbnb services. How do you think this change, specifically stripping out the guest list requirement, affects one's constitutional rights?
Well, I think that this change was necessitated because we did raise some good points in our lawsuit that the city and the judge, they could not let this law go through without making these changes. For example, the city of Los Angeles, the Patel case, made it so that you couldn't even go to a hotel and get guest records on demand without a warrant or subpoena. So that's a clear precedent that this law was written in the face of. Similarly, under the compelled speech doctrine, they couldn't require hosts to sign on to government orthodoxy that they understand the law that even the city doesn't understand. So I think that these adjustments are clearly in response to what we've done. We think that it needs to that this does not go far enough. That the regulation that they put on homeowners still impinges upon their constitutional rights in an unconstitutional way. So that we would like to see further changes made.
Sorge, how do these regulations that they have on the home sharing or entities, how do they differ with what hotels have as far as regulations? And in your opinion, is this unduly burdensome upon the home sharing entities as compared to hotels?
Well, first of all, these are not regulations on the home sharing entities per se, as much as they are on the hosts who are individuals. These differ substantially. If you were to look at the hotel ordinance, it's two pages. This is a 57-page ordinance. The penalties for a hotel is $250 if they're in violation. The penalties for hosts run from $3,000 to $5,000 per day per violation. The inspection requirements, you might think that hotels are subject to building and building code and other kinds of health inspections, but actually they're only required to meet sanitary and ventilation inspections. Whereas under this law, for hosts, they're subject to requirements that if they have food in their apartment, they will have to completely renovate their kitchen to meet commercial kitchen standards, that they are subject to a full slate of building code on-demand inspections by the building department. It's not limited in the way that a hotel inspection is limited.
So, Serge, why? The obvious question is why? And to answer that question, I think you need to look at food trucks as an example. We've covered the food truck debate on this show. Food truck operators are up in arms over what they consider incredibly burdensome ordinances in Chicago that basically require, them to jump through a ton of hoops just to operate. This sounds like a similar argument on behalf of Airbnb owners that hotel owners, just like restaurant owners, don't have these requirements. It sounds like hotel owners don't have near the requirements that the city of Chicago has placed on Airbnb. The obvious question is why? Is it just a case of incredible lobbying efforts by hotel owners and operators, and the fact that Airbnb is, a startup, relatively new company, not having the power that hotel big corporations have? Is that one of the reasons, or is there something else driving the ordinance here?
I think there's a combination of things. I think that there is definitely, the protectionist impulse to protect hotel lobbies from the union side as well as the big business side. I think there is also just a general hysteria about Airbnb. It's sort of this backlash that's happened. It's easy to blame Airbnb for all of the ills that are that's happening. It's the last thing that happened. So we were blaming gentrification on Airbnb, even though we're talking about 4,000 units. Everything is blamed on Airbnb hosts, even though there actually have only been 5 problem incidents involving Airbnb hosts in the 10 years or 7 years or whatever that it's been around.
When you compare that to hundreds, thousands of incidents involved, I mean, maybe not thousands, but certainly a great number of incidents involving, hotels, right? I mean, I'm sure you could find a ton of examples of criminal activity happening in hotels. By the way, I say that with a disclaimer as someone who represents a lot of hotel companies and defends those kind of cases. But my point being, you could probably find, just like you could find a ton of, incidents involving cab drivers, that Uber drivers would say, there's hysteria. I'm sure you could find a ton of examples in Chicago of people being, attacked or slipping and falling or having property stolen at hotels, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a fundamental lack of data. And if you look at what's happening in other cities, I mean, there is just this reaction. And, we're talking to a group in New Orleans, for instance, and what they did a little bit differently. They actually went, and it was like a group like ours that partnered with the University of New Orleans and the hospitality department. They produced a study, and that study fundamentally shaped the way the regulation works in New Orleans. Now, it's not perfect, but it's a very different regulation. It's a lot less antagonistic, because once you look at the actual data and what happens, you realize that this isn't such a bad thing, that there's a lot of hysteria, worst case scenario thinking that really doesn't come to pass.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today on Legal Face Off. And, thanks for giving us a little more in depth in there.
Thank you very much.
And now into the home stretch. This is Craig Collins with the Legal Face-Off guys, Rich and Jason, and we do the grab bag, I am told. This is the grab bag portion of the show, correct?
Yes.
I'm getting all this right still?
Absolutely. You're doing well so far, Craig.
I'm patting myself on the back as much as I can. The first topic to discuss is the ex-Lake County coroner indicated on perjury charges over election signatures.
Yeah, Thomas Rudd, the former Lake County coroner, was indicted on felony perjury charges stemming from some petitions that he notarized on the ballot to become Lake County Sheriff. And if you can really recall, he was the Lake County Sheriff the last election cycle, and then this last election cycle, he had put some signatures together on the petition and notarized them as being true and correct, which he's supposed to do. But the only problem is some of these petitions, they were found to be signatures with deceased people on them, and also people that said they actually did not sign the petition. So he tried to do a write-in candidate, and that was not successful. And then he's now indicted on 5 felony perjury accounts stemming from those petitions and signatures on the ballot.
Yeah, so this has been on the news, the last couple of years. There's been a series of, and by the way, this is Lake County, Illinois, just northwest part of Chicagoland area, been in the news over the last couple of years, including with the death of Glenowitz, the police officer, Joseph Glenowitz. This coroner was criticized pretty heavily for releasing some private information about the investigation into Glenowitz's death.
He was actually the first one to actually come out and say, too, that it's possible that this may have been a self-inflicted gunshot wound
from
Glenowitz, and he was highly criticized by the sheriffs up in Lake County.
Right.
All right, guys, so we move on to Dorothy Brown, and did she take bribes? Did she take loans? Big question mark on the rundown here, so tell me, what happened there?
Dorothy Brown, as you mentioned, is the Cook County Circuit Court Clerk. She was reelected last year, even though the Democrat Party of Cook County withdrew its endorsement of her after it was announced that the federal government was investigating her for a number of alleged improprieties. Despite that, she still won. Again, Cook County, very Democrat heavy area of the country. Now, on Friday of last week, Cook County, actually federal prosecutors here in Cook County, announced that for the first time, they actually called it a bribe. Again, there was a federal investigation, and they had alleged certain things. But for the first time, the assistant U.S. attorney here in the Northern District said that she had taken a bribe, basically an employee that got a job with her office had given her 2 loans. She called it loans The feds are calling it a bribe, totaling $15,000.
It was a loan
to a company called
Goat Meat Company.
Yeah,
right?
Goat Masters Corporation.
Wait, is this a company that processes goat meat or gets food ready for goats?
Either way, I'm not interested in eating it. but yeah, she, Dorothy Brown, and her husband own this company called Goat Masters Corp. And the federal government is alleging that in exchange for $15,000, this individual was given a loan. She's come out and denied it. She says it's impossible inherently in that office to sell any jobs. But the feds now have charged her with bribery. Again, another ongoing political scandal here in Cook County.
Yeah, there was a little bit more to it. This investigation, too, they had uncovered cell phone text messages and voicemails, too, that Dorothy Brown had denied existed. But there was a phone call from the witness's wife who called Dorothy Brown and said, we need to meet, not talk over the telephone. Et cetera, et cetera. So it's same thing with Chicago politics.
Again, it falls under the category of, like, how are people so dumb as to text and create paper trails for these things? We've seen it on so many occasions here, but
yeah, just go to the payphone.
To happen.
Yeah. That's the way you're supposed to do
exactly.
It.
Or have all your conversations in person, right?
Right.
No reason to do anything else. All right, so we'll move on to the third topic here on the rundown, and give me a second. I had to click some stuff out. So the once anonymous plaintiff, Norma McCorvey, and this has been in the news a lot, Roe versus Wade. She unfortunately passed away at 69 recently.
Yeah, Norma McCorvey, who was the Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade, passed away recently. She had kind of a complex life, though. She started out, the case started out initially when she was 22, unmarried, unemployed, and pregnant for the third time. She was denied an abortion in Texas, and that's where the litigation all occurred. But she had quite a shift throughout her life. She eventually became a Christian, then converted to Catholicism, and rejected her previous abortion movement and turned more towards the anti-abortion movement. So she passed away peacefully, the obituary says, at her nursing facility with her family around her.
Yeah, she wrote a book called I Am Roe, talking about, you know, the whole case and her life. Obviously, as Craig mentions, in the news lately because the pick of Trump to replace Scalia, Judge Gorsuch, that will be a central question that will be asked of him during his hearings, is his feelings on Roe v. Wade. As we've covered extensively, he probably won't answer it, but this is where it all began.
I was just going to say she nestled a lesbian lifestyle in there in between the history of pro-abortion then anti-abortion. But then she left her that relationship and she became a Christian.
Yeah, she then said that she thought that homosexuality was wrong after she converted.
Wow. We move on to NFL concussion lawyers ask for $112 million. Under Armour is suing. And Daryl Revis got robbed? These are all things that happened.
Actually, we're just covering the first part of it.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right, let's try this one more time.
Yeah.
So now we move on to an NFL concussion story. Lawyers are asking for $112 million. Explain to me what's going on there.
In news that will warm the heart of Jason Whiteside, we've got attorneys asking, as you mentioned, for attorney fees and costs up to $112 million. So we've covered the NFL concussion litigation extensively on this show. Earlier this month, earlier in February, a federal judge announced that applicants can now apply for part of the $1 billion settlement. So as you'll recall, over the last couple of years, Judge Anita Brody of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania presided over this settlement process whereby the NFL agreed to put money into a fund for NFL alumni who allege that they've had injuries, most specifically CTE, resulting from their NFL careers. And to avail yourself of that money, you have to apply for it and be approved. The trade-off in the settlement, again, as we've covered, is that the plaintiffs will not have to prove causation in exchange for giving up the right to sue the NFL in court. Now, there's been about 160 players who have opted out of the settlement who do want to take their case to court. But there's about 22,000 retired NFL players, of which it's estimated that about 6,000 will be able to prove avail themselves of the settlement. So the news that you're referring to is attorneys last week put in their cut, and they're alleging that they're owed about $112 million for their work.
Lots of work going on there, huh? $112 million.
Yeah, very,
sounds pretty fair.
Very difficult.
Yeah, it's going to cover everything for sure.
Right.
Not the best settlement. You know, I came out when we talked about this, I was very critical of the settlement. I think it's not nearly enough money. I'm sure Jason would, you know, agree. On the other hand, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect case. The difficulty in proving that you suffered some kind of damage from playing the NFL is causation. You know, who's to say that the NFL versus college versus, you know, peewee football?
Yeah, and also, too, I mean, I don't know how the NFL would even prevent, I mean, just arguing on the flip side, I don't know how the NFL would even prevent those concussions from occurring or know that those did occur. I know there's a lot of evidence out there that, you know, they've known for 15 years, but there's still, I mean, there's neurosurgeons we talk to and neurologists that say that CTE has no relation whatsoever to the NFL and those concussions and brain injuries that they suffer. So,
Legal Grab Bag continues here. We're talking about a prison story. Joe Giudice gets a prison job. Is this correct?
Yeah, everyone knows Joe Giudice from the Real Housewives of, I think, New Jersey.
Jersey.
But him and his wife, his wife already did prison time. He's doing prison time for lying on their bankruptcy forms and concealing money from the federal government. So, but apparently he had a hard time adjusting to prison, but now is able to get, he got a job and he makes about $100 a month for his labor working in the prison gym. Apparently he's lost a good 30 pounds. And looks amazing, according to his wife. So he still has, what was it, about another, I think, 17, 18 months left on his sentence. But
I love the prison gym idea. Like, what better way
yeah.
for felons who have committed violent crimes to spend their time yeah. is getting bigger
the only thing
in
that
a
would
prison
make that
gym.
Is if they had, like, a mixed martial arts
yeah,
class.
Exactly. let's put these people who have already committed physical violent crimes yeah. back in a place where they could get physically more violence.
Yeah. Give like a medieval element to it with yeah. a broadsword and a battle axe.
Joe Giudice.
Oh, man. Become better criminals in prison. That sounds amazing.
Well, for when they get out, right, Craig?
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. It's career training. Yeah. Now we get to move on to Brian Urlacher's hair. Is that correct?
It's that portion of the show where yeah. we're talking about an ex-bear's
hair. That is wonderful.
Hair.
Transition from prison stories. Hey, there's people in the other. I'm going to edit this part out. Hey, Mike. So now we move on to Brian Urlacher's hair, and you got to tell me, why is this in the news? What's going on? There's some sort of clinic cashing in.
It's so new that, like, we're following his hair every day. It's only been a couple months, right? Yeah, Brian Urlacher, you know, famous Chicago Bear, maybe Hall of Famer probably, right, in a couple years?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah,
he is suing a Florida hair clinic that he claims used his likeness without permission to advertise restoration treatments. Again, last year, very famously, the bald Urlacher became the very hairy Urlacher after using Restore Hair. This was a hair growing company of some kind, all over billboards here in Greater Chicago.
He's got the big the Michael Jordan arm stretch
yeah.
pose everywhere.
Yeah, I am not a client, by the way. And he's suing this company, alleging that they used his likeness without permission. So, trying to protect that likeness,
yeah, you know,
that hairy likeness. Now.
I mean, yeah, he went out on a limb, you know, got the procedure done, and you know, exposing himself to
not a fan. I think he's violated the bald guy trust. As a bald male myself, there's a certain, you know, trust that
once
we all
you're
have
part
each
of the
other.
Group.
Once you're in, you don't go back out. You
yeah.
know, it's like you don't break back into Alcatraz. Once he had a good head too. He had a good skull.
You know, his dome was nicely shaped too.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't uneven anywhere, no bumps.
No.
Yeah, there were no calls for Brian Urlacher to add hair
to his
head.
He's dead to me. He's dead to me. We threw him out lock, stock, and barrel of the
bald
guy club. Yep.
Only one more story.
Did you say balding? No, bald.
He was bald.
I'm
yeah.
way beyond balding.
Well, no, I mean, you still got some hair left, right? You just thick it down,
yeah,
right?
I wear that hair on my face only right now.
Yeah. Balance it out.
I am disappointed to say there's only one story left in the legal grab bag, but this one grabbed my attention. I meant that pun. Bachelorette lead, African-American first lawyer, first African-American. I think a lot of this is news, but I'm surprised you guys are talking about the Bachelorette in general, so I'm psyched.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, it's
Jason's
shocking we're talking about
fan.
This Bachelorette.
Jason tried out for the Bachelor several times.
and then when that didn't work, the Bachelorette.
Yeah,
this,
you know, whatever
beat
what
me
you
out.
Can do.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's a first, Craig. There's so many firsts, right?
Mm-hmm.
First African-American lead, first lawyer. So, yeah, she was an associate of Cooper and Scully. Also happens to be the daughter of a U.S. district judge down in Dallas, graduated from Marquette in 2011, And she, Rich, would love this. She handles commercial litigation and personal injury defense.
Yes, but yeah.
Now, after tackling the law, she's ready to tackle love.
We're going to try to get her on a future legal face-off, Craig.
I'll do that. I got that covered.
We're going to do it live from a location down in Dallas.
It sounds wonderful.
That's what Rich and I do. We travel.
They also, our Bachelor fans tell us that she's the first one, or Bachelorette, the first one to be announced while the show is still going on. Usually they wait until the current show ends. Then they'll announce the new one. They did that while the current show is running. So
I promised myself I wouldn't sneak in many plugs for my own podcast while helping host yours. But I do cover The Bachelorette every week on You've Binge Challenged.
You've Binge Challenged.
So I'm very aware of the whole setup going on
when
here.
When is Lenkov going to be on the show?
Yeah, Lenkov, whenever you want, man. We got to set this up
you know,
real soon. So this is, I think.
Wait, you cover it every week?
Yeah.
Bachelorette? That's your regular.
We only put a podcast out every so often, but my co-host and I talk about it every week.
Bachelorette, she's or Bachelor specifically.
Any Bachelor, any dating show that's called Bachelor or Bachelorette. It is an obsession that I don't totally understand, Rich. Yeah. But
no, when's The Bachelor on Monday night?
Yeah.
Every Tuesday morning, it's like in my office, it's all everyone gathers around and they talk about it.
You guys, we're going viral. This podcast is going viral for hitting this topic.
Let's just keep saying Bachelor, Bachelorette, Bachelor.
History is made. Legal Face Off, Rich Lenkov, Jason Whiteside. I'm Craig Collins.
Once in a while, Sam Penianovich.
Right, yeah. Mostly Sam Penianovich. I thank you guys so much for letting me jump in here, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Craig.